Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zhang, psychotherapist and the founder of the Awareness Integration Therapy. Hello to Sean in our studio.
This is a show about what matters most in our life, our mind, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll share the tip of the week with you about choosing your words wisely. And then I will share in how to live a purposeful life after 60 in the Ask Me segment. I am honored, everyone, and I'm sure you'll be excited to know that Dr. Philip Zimbardo is joining us. He is one of the world's most renowned psychologists and a professor emeritus at Stanford University. He is the author of many amazing books, including The Lucifer Effect, Shyness, Man Interrupted, The Time Paradox, and The Time Cure. He is also the founder and the president of the Heroic Imagination Project. I'm sure you're going to enjoy as much as I enjoy him. I love to hear from you. Connect with me through my website, fujian.com, and follow my social media and message me with your comments and topics of interest. I love to be able to share with you what you're interested in with all the experts. But first, here's the tip of the week.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zhang. You can get it now at fujian.com or amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
Hello, listeners. This is Christopher from The Christopher Show. Hey, if you missed one of our shows here at KMET, don't worry about it. You can go to our webpage, and that's KMET1490AM.com. Go to the homepage, click on the SoundCloud tab, and hear any show anytime you want.
Dr. Fujian here again. This is the tip of the week. This week, I've been working on how much our words matter. It can break or build our relationships, outcomes, and reputation. Our words are a representation of who we are inside. Our words are our thoughts, feelings, and our behavior wrapped into one. The impact of a loving word can build a lifetime of confidence for our children and create joy for our mate, friends, and family. The impact of words of commitment bonds a marriage for years. And inspiring words can make someone at work reach their optimum potential of creativity and productivity. And an abusive word can break your child's heart. A belittling word can damage a friendship. Telling a lie breaks trust. Since our words are a combination of our thoughts, intentions, feelings, and show up through the behavior or talking or writing, choosing our words to create a particular result becomes important. Behaviors have consequences, and at times, irreversible ones. So we can choose to use our words to share who we are authentically or manipulate others to gain something that we think we couldn't get if we simply stated the truth. So observe yourself. Have you used your words to raise positivity for others, to belittle them, to dump your feelings, to manipulate others, to share your love, to negotiate, to request? Have you recognized the impact of your words, whether they're positive or negative? Have you noticed the impact of other people's words on you, whether they're positive or negative? Have you observed your own words towards yourself in your head, the way you talk, positive or negative? Choose your words wisely. They represent you and create your results. For learning more observational skills and tools to raise your self-esteem, go to my book, Life Reset, The Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. We'll be right back.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Hello, this is Dr. Fujian in the Ask Me segment. A wonderful lady has asked, how can we have a life full of purpose after 60? She is growing in the age of 60, and she's trying to find what to do if she's not going to have her career anymore. This conversation is really close to my heart because I am exactly between 59 and 60. November, I will be 60. So this conversation of aging has been a conversation for a while that I've been experiencing from age 40 and then 50s and then 60s, and then work with people who are in their 70s and 80s and 90s and are so much into growth, and not only their own growth, but also giving to the community. So how I would say it is, we create and give and receive love as a child with our family and parents, and then our peers, and then our intimate relationship, and then work and career environment, and then having children, you know, their love to us or our grandchildren to us, and then the society at large. And as we grow, I think that this concept of the wisdom that we have, the personal experience and the experience that we've gained from the world throughout the ages, as how the technology has changed and given us the wisdom, or the medical industry, every aspect of what is out there can be a wow, because in every single industry, the growth is so amazing that it is exciting. You'll never be bored, because if you ever took anything upon yourself to learn, the vast amount of knowledge and experience is so much. So the purpose beyond 60 could be learning new aspects of life, which you've never known before. And, you know, like a child who gets excited about learning, learn until the day you die, or give until the day you die, or you could learn and give all at the same time, which is probably the best way of creating, where you could have that joy, where you don't have to do anything or know anything, or there's no more have-tos. We've done our have-tos. We usually get to an age around 60 and up where we just choose to. And I think that's the beauty of life, getting to choose all that you want to and get excited about choosing. So create your own purpose, maybe all the way to this age. You have lived based on everybody else's, or the community, the society, and your family's basis of who you should have been and how you should have reacted and what your knowledge should have been. And maybe today is the time you choose. It's mine. And I get to do whatever I want. I've gotten to the age which I deserve to do whatever I want and not caring necessarily that, you know, if it's going to handle anybody else's satisfaction. Obviously, as a social being, we'd like to create a group around us that we socialize and we care about each other and give and receive love. But beyond anything, remember, at the day of your deathbed, where you look back at these 30, 40 years beyond 60, and you say, did I do everything that I wanted to do? Is there anything that is left that I haven't done? Is there anything in my bucket list that I want to do? And I think that is the excitement that gives us the being and the joy and the passion. So live every day like it is your last day, and yet enjoy every minute of it.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I am so honored and excited to have Dr. Philip Zimbardo, one of the world's most renowned psychologists and a professor emeritus at Stanford University. He has authored various psychology textbooks for universities and books for public, including The Lucifer Effect, How Good People Turn Evil, Shyness, What It Is and What to Do About It, Man Interrupted, Why Young Men Are Struggling and What We Can Do About It, two books that are amazing about the time paradox and time cure, and they are about the new psychology of time. And the last important concept that I wanted to share with you, he's the president and the founder of Heroic Imagination Project, which you can find at heroicimagination.org. Welcome, Dr. Zimbardo.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm excited to be with you.
I've learned so much from you. I follow you in all of the evolution of psychotherapy. I walk wherever you are, and I've had the honor and the blessing that you've been on my show another time. And I just learned so much of it from you. And I've watched you grow from one thing to another and to another. And it just inspires me to look at first of all, I just want to tell everybody, if you've ever watched Dr. Zimbardo, his presentations are they're vibrant. You bring music, you bring color, you bring, you know, excitement, and we all learn from that. And you take risks. You were the leader of the 1971 Stanford Prison Experiment and an expert witness in the studies, globally about what turns a human being into evil and or act in a heroic act. So, and I know that your experimentations recently have gone a lot of, you know, questioning about your role, and you have a movie. So tell us about that.
Well, let's start with that. I should mention to your audience that on August 14th, 2021, maybe 6 months, it will be the 50th anniversary of the day we started the Stanford Prison Experiment. So it's probably the most well-known experiment ever done in psychology. For some people, it's negative. For others, including me, it's positive. Interestingly, there are two separate documentary film companies that are making competing films about my experiment and trying to relate it to current things like police brutality and putting down black protest movements. So it's for me, it'll be an exciting time. Hopefully, I will live through that period again. But the study very simply was a demonstration of how ordinary people, ordinary, good, smart people, college students from all over the United States, when put in a certain role to be a guard or a prisoner, in a situation that gives those roles validity, like a prison-like setting, they become the role. They become prisoners who rebel at first and then are downbeaten and then give in, give up, and then essentially many of them have a nervous breakdown. And the guards, at first reluctant, nobody wanted to be a guard in 1971 because it was the time of the Vietnam War. And at that time, many policemen went on college campuses beating up students who were protesting. But in a day, within a day or two, almost all of the students playing the role of guards became cruel, creatively evil. And then I had to end the study after 6 days. It was supposed to go for 2 weeks because it was out of control. I mean, five prisoners had breakdowns, and I shut the study down prematurely.
You talk about individual, you talk about three types of evil that people might actually fall into. One is the individual, such as we say, like the person is a bad apple. You also talk about situational, where social and physical environment allows it or demands it. And then a systematic evil, which you've called such as poverty, genocide, slavery, sex trafficking. Right. And when you talk about the experiment itself and then your experimentations on heroic act, or for example, things that just happened in January 6th, where you could see this division of people acting in a particular way, and then other people coming in and being like side by side, you see sometimes this concept of evil and heroic right side by side. What are your thoughts about that? Can you share?
Oh yeah, so January 6th was a horrible event to see, a horrible event to have happened in America. And again, some of it was structural evil. I mean, the people who planned this event, you know, attack on the White House, essentially what it was is to stop the vote, stop the approval of the Electoral College vote to demonstrate that Joseph Biden won the election. And at that point, President Trump lost the election. So there are people who had organized all of this and an attack on the White House. So that was structural. But then people joined in who started off just to be a protester. And then you could see got caught up in it, yelling and screaming. And then you become part of the mob. Even if you're physically there, you're psychologically an outsider. But now people are yelling and chanting and running. And it's really called a mob mentality. You get captured in that thing. And suddenly you're doing what everybody else is doing. You're breaking windows. You're hitting anybody who opposes you. You're beating up policemen. And at that point, you're an ordinary citizen who actually then engages in criminal behavior. So it was horrible to watch. And I must say personally, regardless of politics, I do hope former President Trump is impeached a second time, because he is responsible for creating that riot and for the deaths of five people.
So Dr. Zimbardo, if we look at the concept of, for example, an individual who might be the bad apple, who due to maybe childhood traumas, due to brain injuries, due to different aspects, does do destructive behaviors. And then yet, could that person being in an environment that promotes heroic acts shift, and then vice versa? Can someone who is very healthy psychologically put in, as your experiment, put in a position of a situational or a systemic and fall into it? And then what should people look into as far as the individualism of themselves into choosing instead of automatically falling into this mob concept?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point, is that the number one principle is we have to be aware of our own vulnerability. We all know the extent to which we sometimes conform, comply, obey too easily. We begin as children obeying your parents, obeying your teachers, obeying religious leaders. So we're really taught to obey. But then the problem is, what about leaders who encourage you to do something destructive, like attack the Capitol? So what's really important is for all of us to always monitor our own dispositions, our own tendencies to give in, to comply, to join the group. And then also, and this is where we lead into what I'm talking about in the Heroic Imagination Project, we all have to become social psychologists, meaning every situation we go into has certain dynamics. And we must be sensitive to those dynamics rather than like a robot going in and out of different settings. So in certain dynamic, in certain situations, you can expect maybe bad things to happen because there will be people there who are inviting you, not pushing, they invite you to join the group. They invite you to join the cause. And so it seems good because there are good causes, but there are also bad causes. And so a lot of what I'm talking about is the need to be self-aware and also situationally aware.
You also talk about from the Hero Project that act on behalf of others in need or in defense of moral cause. You share about being aware of the risk to life, finances, and career, usually being modest or humble. They're not really asking for this concept of being a hero everywhere. And moral courage in the care of the heroic act. You share three concepts of heroes: democratization of anyone can be a hero, demystifying it, like no special inner qualities have to be there, essential, and then diffuse away from the solo heroism to a team and ensemble of heroes working pro-social. And I know that you have this project all over the world. So can you share about the project and what you're doing around the world at this time?
Yeah. My Heroic Imagination Project, or the acronym is HIP, H-I-P. In the olden days, when I grew up, it was cool to be hip. And we hope it's cool to be a hero. Now, in the last chapter of my book that you mentioned, The Lucifer Effect, the first 15 chapters are all about evil, of the prison study, about Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, about the Nazi concentration camps. And the last chapter says, we have seen how easy it is for good people to be seduced into doing bad things, even evil things. And now the question is it possible for ordinary people, any of us, to become heroes? That's the question I raised. And I also raised it in a TED talk I gave called The Psychology of Evil at the end of that talk. And I begin by saying, our usual conception of heroes, our heroes are extraordinary people. You know, we go from the Greeks, Odysseus, from Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela and Marie Curie, so Mother Teresa. So we have these people whose whole lives were invested in good causes. But I'm saying no, heroes could be any of us, and you're a hero if you do one act of what I call sociocentric act, one act that helps someone in need. You don't have to have a lifetime of heroism to be called a hero. Now, the other issue is like there's the Carnegie Foundation that every year announces heroes. In almost every case, those heroes are people, mostly men, who have died in action, helping others. So it comes out of the war, out of wartime, where you die taking a bullet for your buddy, is the phrase. But also it's policemen and firemen and first responders. And I'm saying, no, that's one definition of hero. I'm talking about people who come to the aid of somebody who is hurt, who is bleeding, who's falling down. You don't enter a burning house that's on fire. Your job is to call the fire department, to call the police, to yell instructions about how people could go out in a fire escape and come walk down. So we try to create wise and effective heroes who achieve their goal without sacrificing their lives or without sacrificing the lives of others. And then what we do is I have created very vibrant lessons that we license to schools and now in businesses and human relations about how to transform passive bystanders into active upstanders, how to transform prejudice and discrimination into understanding and acceptance of others who are different from you. And then also another lesson is how to develop a growth mindset in place of having a static fixed mindset. So each of these lessons are very dynamic. You mentioned vibrant. The lessons are lessons. These are things, many of these are things I used to teach. So there are videos and audios and demonstrations and built-in little experiments. And so we've been using them now, really, as you said earlier, around the world in 12 different countries, where obviously they're translated into Hungarian or Polish or Italian or other languages, and they make it obviously culturally relevant. But and then we demonstrate that they work. There's a reduction in bullying, there's a reduction in prejudice, there's an increase in leadership, and essentially people who've gone through the lesson say, I feel better about myself having this heroic armament around me.
Certainly, people feel better about themselves when they are in the heroic stance versus the, you know, the part of them that goes after a destruction. One of the books that you have, Shyness, and you've done a lot of studies around shyness, and especially in men, you conceptualize shyness as a self-imposed, I love the sentence you put, as a self-imposed psychological prison in which the shy individual is both guard and reluctant prisoner, limiting freedoms of speech, association, and action. And you also share about the tech revolution, where how it has been replacing people face-to-face communication versus, you know, the text then being away from each other, especially well after COVID also, I think it became norm. But I've also shared a sense that, you know, boys, gravitate toward gaming and consistently being around the gaming versus girl. And it's been part of my question. And I'm asking some of the neuroscientists to actually do some, you know, longitudinal studies about what happens to the brain of a male versus female after introducing decades of these games that usually boys and men go toward versus female. Right. Your thoughts, please, on shyness and games and all of it.
Well, let's start with the games that go backwards. Is that it would be exciting to have neuroscientists begin, as many maybe they're doing it, to do this research, to do some longitudinal studies of young boys and young girls of the same age over even a 2 or 3 year period, because I think their brains are altered. That is, because you're living in this very tight physical, mental concept where, and it's almost always war game, there's always an enemy. So, and your job is to kill. Mm-hmm. So it's you get points for all the planes you shoot down, all the enemies you kill. And then what I mention in my book, Man Disconnected, is that many of these boys get, when I say get addicted, I mean they play up to 10 hours or more every day or every night. They're locked in their room. Their parents don't know what they're doing. But see, in fact, for many mothers, they say, well, he's safe. He's in his room. He can't get in trouble. But he's getting in trouble because he's altering his brain. Now, the other thing that happens is, even though the games are exciting, after a while, the boy needs a release. And the release is they switch to watch pornography online. You know, so their whole life is violent video games and actually violent conquest of women in pornography. And the sad thing is many of them then give up wanting to have a girlfriend or wanting to have girls as friends. And this is very, very sad that again, I mean, it's, I think we're creating a whole generation of young men who feel they don't need women. The women they need, if they get in pornography, they don't need social contact or social connections or even friends, because they get that in war games. and it's really bad.
What my experience was even yesterday was our grandchild, which is about 6 or 7 years old, he had this new game that he was playing, and it wasn't even that violent, but the whole point was 6 hours, we couldn't get this away from him. And even when we finally said, okay, you know, let's watch a movie together, let's do other things, you know, the amount of dopamine that this thing surges in your head and you get addicted to it, when you're trying to, you can't enjoy anything else. Like the enjoyment of anything else is taken away from you. And it was a battle of this, you know, he kept going back and wanting it, and nothing else could satisfy him.
Oh yeah, so there's a case, it's a wonderful example that you give, that here's a young child, you know, I've been talking mostly about teenagers, but now,
This is where it starts. It starts actually at this age, and by then they're completely hooked.
Yeah, well, I mean, parents or friends give a gift of a video game, you know, even though they cost several hundred dollars, so it's not inexpensive. But once they start playing, the games are designed to be enhancing. I mean, entrancing is the way. They entrancing. Your whole world is between here and here. On this game, and it means you don't want to socialize. I mean, even with parents, you know, say you have to beg, please, grandma is here, she'd like to spend some time with you to talk, what are you doing, and so forth, or let's watch a movie, let's even have dinner. For many of these boys, their mothers just put the dinner, knock on the door, they put the dinner there. They no longer have family dinners. So this now is a breakdown of what used to be the most important thing, individuals in families connecting at least once a day, having a family dinner. And now even that's being broken down by these video games.
Very much. Yeah. You share about it in the past, shyness was not knowing how to navigate the social landscape and not knowing how to ask for directions and going like forward. New shyness is being unwilling to ask for directions, not wanting to connect with others. And that's what you're saying. Like you kind of go in being so comfortable in your own virtual reality that just being away, it becomes the norm. So then it becomes so hard when these kids want to enter not only the relationship, intimate relationship in marriages, but also workforces.
Right, of course, that's a good addition. Now, so in the olden days when I first started studying shyness, I have to mention, right after I did the prison study, because as you highlighted very nicely, in talking to my students at Stanford after my class, after the experiment, I said, I presume none of you are planning to be a prison guard. None of you are planning to be a prisoner. And so why should you be interested in this study? Well, I said, I know many of you are shy from my interaction with you. And we can think of shyness as a self-imposed psychological prison, where you become your own prisoner by saying, I can't ask the girl for a date. I can't ask the teacher to answer my question. I can't ask the boss for a raise. And that you create your own psychological prison. And then once you put yourself in it, then the guard in you says, now you can't get out because people will laugh at you. Nobody wants to know you. And I know you said earlier, some of your audience is psychotherapists. We started a shyness clinic at Stanford when I was working there, which is now still functioning in Palo Alto University, which is a clinical training program in Palo Alto. And our training focuses on identifying in each client or each person, three elements. One is lack of communication skills. A second one is cognitive, what you're saying, I'm dumb, I'm ugly, I'm too fat, I'm too skinny, and nobody will like me. And the third one is physiological, you blush, have difficulty talking. And this. So then we have a treatment for each of those three components. For the first one, we really, in quote, we send you to Actors Studio. We teach you how to give a communication, how to talk, how to present yourself, just as if you're going to an Actors Studio. And the second thing is cognitive behavior therapy. We get you to change what you say to yourself. You're not dumb, you're ugly. I simply take a little bit longer than other people informing my answer. And then the third is we teach you relaxation skills to relax, control your emotions so you stop blushing, and so each of those three, when done well, we get 100% cure. Our treatment is always in a group because shyness is a group phenomenon. We've been doing this for 30 or 40 years, and we are 100% successful in our treatment. So I would encourage, now the other problem with shyness is you're too shy to go to treatment for your shyness.
That's true. What would your suggestions be for parents of young boys or teen boys regarding this type of, getting addicted to the two concepts of first, obviously, gaming and electronics, and then porn? You share about looking at fatherlessness and single motherhood rising around the world. And obviously, they don't have time to constantly monitor. And most of the teenagers hate being monitored anyway. So they would fight over that concept. What would your suggestion be?
Yeah, you raise an important note, is that it's a phenomenon that's happening in America and now around the world. Of young people growing up without a father, many parents getting divorced, and it's actually being worse during the pandemic, where men and women who are married are living together, or couples living together, and they realize they don't have anything in common, or they don't have enough in common to keep going, and in many cases they get divorced, and custody always goes to the wife. And so you have in America, maybe 50% of all young children grow up without a father in the home. Now, young girls don't need a father as much as they need a mother, because that's their role model. But boys need a father. Fathers give love unconditionally. Fathers say, you have to get good grades in school if you want your allowance. You have to do homework, et cetera. Mothers say, I love you no matter what. You are my child. You are my blessing in life. So one of the things we argue is we need to have uncles and cousins step in where you have a relative who doesn't have a father. And essentially to do things with them which do not involve gaming. Take them to a sports event. Take them to the zoo. Take them to a playground. Essentially doing things in the open air, so it's fresh. Take them on a hike. Just open the world to them, that there's a world beyond the video game and the world beyond the pornography. I think in some communities there are starting to be men's groups, who like men who almost adopt a kid. And let's say every Saturday they meet together to do some task. And I would encourage that everywhere.
Like a big brother or a mentorship, like a big brother concept.
Yeah, right.
So what I'm hearing from you is the most important factor is connection. If they actually get a connection with another male, the male bonding that is there, it raises them to a space of wanting that type of a connection, and then therefore be willing to let go of that whatever device is, because the connection associates with positivity for them.
Yeah, I mean, you realize that for the first time they realize it's fun to be connected to somebody else, or fun to do something that somebody says, hey, you're a good kid, or you're a handsome guy, or that's a nice idea. Your video game, all you get is a score. You get, the more you play, the higher your score is. But But then you realize the importance of that social connection. You know, again, it's almost the opposite of the shyness, as we're saying. Video games, I presume, we haven't done the research. I presume this is, again, what shy kids would be really good at, because it does involve personal connections. But, you know, as a social psychologist, as a parent, I believe that, and as a Sicilian, nothing is more important than family, friends, connection, and we're losing that. I'm worried about the coronavirus quarantine, because many, many young people are now figuring out how to live a life without anybody else, or live a life with people on Zoom, with fake people.
Absolutely. And social media is also adding to that, where they can be whomever they want in this virtual way of not facing even consequences for their conversation, but they could just blow out anything without any type of connection. But also we've seen that engaging in social media has created more isolation for kids, more depression and anxiety, and even higher level of suicide, because they only see like the greatness of others and feel like I'm completely separate, because they're not in the reality of the connection of one-on-one.
Oh yeah. And again, even for, that's where young girls get in trouble. You know, girls put on a picture of themselves looking beautiful with makeup, or even they will adjust the image. And other girls say, gee, I'm ugly compared to her. No wonder all the boys like her, you know, and not me. So again, it's a lot of the social media creates negative social comparisons for many young girls.
Yes. I want to switch to your next wonderful psychology methodology. And this is the time zone. It's the time paradox, the flow of human experience into different time frames or time zones. And you talk about six main time zones. Would you share about that?
Sure. So the other thing that came out of the prison study, beside the work on shyness, was trying to understand the psychology of time. Because in that study, no one was allowed to wear a wristwatch, none of the staff, and it was in a basement, so there was no daylight or night. And so in a very short time got distorted. Each guard shift was 3 hours, a morning, afternoon, evening. And so much happened in each shift that it began to feel like that was a whole day to me and my staff, as well as to the prisoners. And, you know, and so after 2 or 3 days, it felt like the experiment had been going on for a week or more. And then when it was all over, you know, I just reflected on, you know, on the distortion that even in my own mind. And I began to think about, you know, how do we construct time zones or time frames? And I started to interview people and talk to people I travel around the world from different countries. And I realized the obvious three things are past, present, and future. But the more I talked to people, the more I thought about it, I said each of them has a positive and negative dimension. So if I ask you, tell me about your past, some people will talk about the good old times, family events, the time you got a commendation, you got an A, you got your driver's license. Or other people, same age, same background, they say failure, rejection, not getting what I needed, not getting what I wanted. So the past then is some, for some it's past positive, some past negative. And then for the future, again, the reason you go to school is to develop a future orientation. You plan today for what's going to evolve tomorrow. So it's really good to have a future orientation, but for some people, it becomes negative. You worry about, if I set a goal, I might not be able to reach it. I might not have the talent. I might have the money. I might get the help. So the future can also be positive and negative. And then for the present, for some people, we call it present fatalism. You say, nothing I do makes a difference. You know, I'm poor, I have a second-rate job. In fact, now during the COVID era, I lost my job. Now the contrast, so that's negative. But there are people who always they're fatalists to say, it's me, nothing I do makes a difference, okay? On the other side is present hedonist, is to say, I enjoy life, I enjoy people, I enjoy fun, I enjoy new things, I enjoy travel. It's I enjoy something. So they consume life, they consume, they want friendship, they want, sociability. So I developed a scale, the Zimbardo Time Perspective Inventory, which measures the degree to which people have each of those categories. And then we did lots of research. And this research is also many people I've inspired around the world. So we have an international time perspective foundation. And we demonstrate that what is the ideal, we call it balanced time perspective, BTP. It means being low on past negative, high on past positive, low on present fatalism, moderately high on present hedonism, low on negative future, high on positive future. In my book, the Time Paradox, I describe the scale. But if your audience goes online, thetimeparadox.com, they can take the scale and they can score it themselves immediately. And then you get a graph with your scores compared to what we think is ideal. And ideal is for people who've been successful in life, in business, happy, successful marriage.
That is fantastic. I definitely will have also my group, and we're doing a lot of studies, and I'll share with you later. I would love to have that scale to also present it in our studies to the students. Sure. We're doing a lot of studies in universities because obviously you know that the university sophomores and freshmen have the highest level of anxiety and depression and level of suicide. So I would love to have that to be part of the scales that we utilize. Obviously, we utilize the depression and anxiety scales, but if I can also have that, I would love to put that.
It's really good. Yeah, and then also in the later book you mentioned that I did with Rosemary Sword, time therapy. It's how do you change a negative time frame into a more positive one. And we give very, very practical, specific advice. The scale is usable. Anybody can use it. There's no limits or free fees or anything. It's just we hope you will share the result that we then put online for everybody.
Absolutely. One of the things that I saw in your presentation was also this concept that was really interesting about some languages, like cultures might be, the culture and the language might be future oriented or present oriented or past oriented. And you shared, for example, you know, Sicily from northern to southern, they have different type of time frames. And I sense that, for example, I'm from Iran. So I learned how to do take people into their emotions in a non-direct way, and I learned that obviously in English because I studied in the United States. But I was trying to do this in Farsi with my clients who only are like monolingual Farsi, and it was so hard to take the same language and shift it. And then when you shared about that some languages and cultures completely are future oriented or past oriented, it really hit home. Can you share a little bit about that?
Oh yeah, it's a really good point. Is that, see, some of this is really very subtle. I mean, it's one thing to talk about a shy person, but some of the influences on us as individuals come from culture. Well, culture is a wraparound, it's everywhere. So my family is Sicilian. Both are my grandfather, maternal and paternal grandfather's side. I have a foundation. I go to Sicily every year. We give scholarships to high school students to go to college. I've been doing it for 16 years now. This year we couldn't because of the COVID. But essentially it's the dramatic difference between Sicilians and people from Southern Italy, maybe Naples down versus above Rome north. The people above Rome, Rome and above, are really heavily influenced by Austrian Germanic backgrounds, which are very individually egocentric, individually centered. In the South, it's sociocentric. It's family comes first. Family is number one. And so in the South, it's always we. In the North, it's always I or me. And then again, in the language, the language of the South is much more focusing on the present and the past, enjoying the moment, okay? Enjoying, you know, a mother can spend 2 or 3 hours making Sunday pasta sauce, and the family could spend 2 or 3 hours eating it. And then, you know, and so they live in the present. Well, if you're from the North, that's a waste of time. So time becomes stretched in the South and compressed in the North. So in the North, I always make fun to say, Bruno brings his lunch in a paper bag, you know, whereas in the South, you know, you go home for lunch because your mother's going to have pasta ready for you. So we are influenced. I mean, the bottom line in everything that you've outlined is that it's really interesting for all of us to think about what influences who I am, what influences what I do, what are the influences on how I think, and where do they come from? Some are from society, some are from our culture, some are from the present environment, a COVID environment versus a post-COVID environment. Some are from things like video games or using cell phones. And so all of us should be psychologists because we should be the object of our psychology to better understand what we do, how we do it, and how we could do life, how we could enjoy life more and do things better. You know, so it's not simply you're a psychologist observing other people, like putting them in a microscope. For me to be a psychologist is, what can I learn about myself that I could share with other people in lectures, in books, in psychological articles that make people enjoy their life more fully? Because we're here for a very short time, and essentially we want to enjoy that time as much as possible. Now, you mentioned Iran. I visited Iran maybe 5 years ago. I gave lectures all over, many, and then I went to the ancient cities in the north, and it was absolutely wonderful, a wonderful experience. I'd love to go back. I still have regular communication with some of the women who are my hosts, and we send email back and forth. So that's a positive use of technology. Even though we're millions, thousands of miles away, you know, I once a month, the three of them and me, we get online and we share what's happening in our lives.
Dr. Zimbardo, in 1 minute, if we haven't touched about something that you really want our audience to know about your work, about yourself, what would that be?
Oh, please visit our hero website, heroicimagination.org. And again, see how you could use our ideas in your family, in your school, in your work. Everything I do is free access. You could take any of our videos and use them. And essentially it's, you know, each of us should say, what can I do to make the life better for someone else? So again, it's in your mind. Instead of I and me, it should be we and us. I have to suppress being egocentric and promote being sociocentric. And so that is, for me, that should be the goal in life for all of us.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for all that you do for the psychology world, for the risks you take, for the passion that you have for people. So thank you. And thank you for creating so many amazing projects around the world. Everyone, please go to heroicimagination.org. How could people support you in that heroicimagination.org? I know it's a nonprofit organization. It's teaching people how to stand up, speak out, and change the world. How would you like them to support you in the Heroic Imagination Project? Oh,
thank you. If you go to the site, there's a way you can make a small donation. You get a tax write-off. So anything you can give, any small amount, we would really value. And again, my birthday is March 23rd. I will be 88. So you can send it in also as a birthday present to me. And if you put your name, I will even answer your information.
I can say I want to grow up to be just like you at 88. Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. And for all of you out there, create an amazing world for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.